Next on RadioSt.Pete.com, Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Tragos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field.
Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And today's special guest is a retired judge named George Greer. A lot of people in the community know him from some of his high-profile, controversial cases, one of which, the Terry Schiavo case, we're going to get to and dig into at the end of the podcast. But for the first part of the podcast, we're going to talk about what it's like to be a judge, what you have to go through, what the decision-making is like. And he's retired now and still is a mediator and handles mediations and all sorts of civil cases. So he's a really cool guest. We're going to learn a lot. If you guys want to hear about a specific topic, as always, find us on social media. PeterTragos@GreekLaw.com is my email. You can send it to us any way you want, and we'll try to answer the question the best we can. All right, so we're excited to have Judge Greer here with us, and I can't really help. And one of the things I was gonna ask is, how often do people still refer to you as Judge Greer? Is it like President, where it kind of lasts forever, since so much of your life was committed to the legal profession, especially the judicial portion? And you know, now when you go to mediations or you do something else, do people still call you Judge Greer?
More often than not.
Yeah, that's what I would expect. And I mean, that's how I would be forever, even though I never even practiced in front of you, but I just have always known you as Judge Greer. So we're going to get into kind of your legal career and how you got to where you are now and going through some of the portions today. Dad, and you want to kind of start it off of where you want to start?
Well, I think we met over 40 years ago, and Clearwater was a much smaller bar at that time. And you were practicing in private practice at the time. Then you went to public service. And what was the first elected office that you had?
I was a Pinellas County Commissioner for 8 years.
Right. And then from there...
How'd you get into that? Why did you pick that as opposed to just practicing?
Well, it was funny. I was doing zoning and land use. And as part of that, you need to support people that you want to support your position when you go in for an administrative matter. And I was supporting people that were getting beat, that they were doing crazy stuff. And then I had to deal with the person who beat them, who didn't like the person they beat, and they certainly didn't like his or her supporters. So I finally decided I may as well, you know, run myself. At least I can handle it myself. And there was an issue in the county at the time that I thought was a good issue. It was this the stadium in St. Pete, and there was one member of the opposite party on the county commission who was up for re-election, who was a swing vote on the county funding that. So I'd been attorney for the party for 3 years prior to that, so I decided to run, and I did.
And then why did you decide to become a judge?
George, I always wanted to be a judge. I always thought that was the zenith of our profession. And I came close to doing it in 1972. Remember when we went to the two-tier trial courts?
Right.
And we had brand new county court judgeships, no incumbents. But I've always wanted to procrastinate. I never have gotten around to doing that. And by the time I got looking at that, there was somebody in each of the five seats that I wanted to support. So I didn't run, which was a good move for my part.
When you say you go to the two trial court, you mean that's when county court started?
Circuit court, right.
Okay. So
it's when the 1968 new constitution took effect for Article 5.
Okay. Before you were born.
Yeah, I was going to say, that seems like a faraway land. okay, so that was 1972, but it wasn't for another, 20 years till you actually took the jump. So what did you do between then, when you thought about being a judge to when you actually became one?
Well, I practiced law,
okay.
And then in 1984 I ran for the county commission, which conflicted me out of all the zoning and land use I'd been doing, and so I'm back to a general practice. Did very little criminal, not nearly as much as your father, who's one of our premier criminal defense lawyers.
I don't think anybody
lawyers.
Does as much criminal as he does. I sure as heck try not to. So then after that, how does the process start? You want to be a judge, what do you do?
Well, you have to run for election for the trial bench in Florida.
Actually, there's two ways. You don't have to run. You can also be appointed by the governor, right?
Right.
So you chose to run.
I did.
Yeah.
And I did that for two reasons. I was a sitting elected official, and going to a judgeship was not a promotion. So I'd asked the voters for 4 years twice. And absent a promotion, I thought I ought to give it to them. That was the purest reason. The selfish reason was that back then you had to run in the first election after the appointment. Now it's the first election more than 1 year from the appointment. And somebody got appointed with Judge Stoudemire in Tampa in like March, got defeated in August. So the local newspaper was not a fan of mine when I was on the county commission. And I was just a little concerned that if I applied and got appointed, that my political base would go somewhere else because I can't do them any good anymore. And the Times would still remember they didn't like me and that I could have a problem. So I waited until 92. There were five open seats and 14 of us running for five seats. And when the dust cleared, I didn't have an opponent.
You also had a good, you did, I know you said about your base, but as a county commissioner, you had a county-wide base.
Yes.
Really, people knew you county-wide, and those judges have to run county-wide.
Well, a circuit has to run two counties.
Right, Pasco too, because we're part of the same circuit, you're right.
Right.
So, and that's interesting, we did a podcast actually on how judges get appointed or how you vote in judges, and a lot of the times either people don't vote, or if they just happen to recognize a name on there, that's who they vote for. You know, we talked about that and we read some surveys about how low the percentage is really that people want to get out and vote for these judges, yet how it's more important than a lot of the things they actually do get out and vote on. So having a name people knew probably made a big difference. But what was the process like when you said, you know, you started with 14 people running for five seats, and when the dust cleared, you didn't have an opponent. So what happens in that campaigning portion in between?
Well, you're running just like you have an opponent. And for a while, I actually had an opponent. Someone got in the race I had qualified for, or I'd opened my account for. Qualifications like a week long. I just opened an account designating a seat I was running for. And we talked, and about 4 or 5 weeks later, he called me and said, I've gone to people I've been socially intimate with for 25 years, and they told me you had been there 6 months ago. So I'm out. Good luck. And then somebody circled me till the very end. I didn't know where she was going until I actually got a copy of the Secretary of State's initial thing on the last day of qualifying.
You said you qualified for a specific seat. How do you do that?
It's just like running for a seat in the Florida House of Representatives.
Okay.
They're called groups. I was in Group 18. That was Judge Michael's group. He retired in 92. And there were four others up that time. It started off with two being vacant, and then there were three more retirements once the process got underway. So a total of five circuit judgeships.
Yeah. You're retired. And what is the retirement for a circuit judge? I know we're jumping ahead, but one of the reasons we can ask you a lot of questions today, and you can express yourself today like you might have not have been able to do when you were a judge, is because you are retired. So how does that happen? So you become a judge, and what year was that?
I went on the bench in 1993, January.
All right. You knew then when your retirement would have to be, right? Did you know then?
Pretty much. I mean, I had to get reelected twice, but back then the retirement age in the Constitution was 70, unless you're more than halfway through your term. Then you can finish your term. I knew if I'd have done the math, I didn't go into it at the time, but if I'd done the math, I would have seen that my third term would have ended when I'm like 12 and a half months away from being 70.
Meaning you couldn't go another term.
I could, but I would have to step down when I hit
12 and
70.
A half months, right. As opposed to if it would have been, like you said, more than halfway, then you could have finished.
Yes.
Okay.
Now they've amended the Constitution. They've taken it to age 75, but it's a drop-dead number. If you're two-thirds of the way through your term and you get 75, you have to retire.
One of the things also we do in Pinellas County is when you're a judge, you don't necessarily are judge in a particular division. In other words, you become a judge, you say Group 18. Well, you may not be criminal the entire time you're a judge. You may be a criminal judge sometimes, providing for criminal trials, civil judge, civil trials, probate, where it's like wills, you're adjudicating those. How does that work in Pinellas County with the fact that you have to be in so many divisions and have to rotate?
It's funny. If you will remember, and you and I have been lawyers about the same amount of time, although I'm much older. It used to be it was the division the judges wanted to be in. They wanted to be in the criminal division or they wanted to be in the civil division. Virtually nobody wanted to be in the family division.
Because they do divorce work.
But it evolved over time, and about halfway through my 18 years, the push judges wanted to be in a building. Clearwater, downtown Clearwater, criminal complex out on Roosevelt, on 49th Street, I mean. St. Petersburg. It didn't matter what the division was as long as they were in that building. So you do move around. I started in juvenile and tried cases in every division. We still have five divisions. Juvenile is now called Unified Family.
So how does it work when you, if you were, because you said you did a little bit of criminal work, you did, you know, some land use stuff, although I'm not sure that really comes across any judges' desks, but what happens if you, if a case or someone you're, you did work on or did work with or did work against comes in front of you as a judge, how do you deal with that?
Well, I used to say it when I was on the bench, and I still say it, that if I had to get off of every case in which I knew somebody,
right,
I'd have three files, because I grew up here.
Right.
I mean, you know the, you know all the lawyers. You know a lot of the litigants. If it's a government, you know the mayor. You just know people. And that's not a requirement to get off. I actually tried a case, presided over a case, where I literally knew or had represented everybody who testified. And the lawyers knew it, and nobody invited me off.
So basically what you're saying is you just deal with it in a fair and impartial way like you're supposed to deal with every case.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And being a county commissioner was good training for that, because one of my concerns about being a judge is, I like your dad. How could I rule against your dad? Mm-hmm. And being a county commissioner, I probably voted 10,000 times. And then a lot of times I had to vote against people I liked, had to vote in favor of people that were not particularly nice, but that's what the evidence or that's what the facts told me to do.
So it basically taught you impartiality.
It did.
Yeah, you look at it with your own eyes, use your own brain, and make the decision you think's the right decision.
Yes.
And in those days, I guess, the person you're ruling against didn't really take it personal, didn't say, oh, you know, I don't like Judge Greer anymore because he ruled against me. Do you think things have changed?
Well, George, this is my 10th year off the bench, so right. I'm not sure what's going on the bench now. I know things have changed in other areas of professional life to where it does get very personal. As a judge, well, as a county commissioner, it's important for the public to, they know you can't support everything they want to do, but they do want to be heard. So it's important that you listen to what they have to say. If you can't agree with them, you tell them why you can't agree, why you're just adopting a different position. And I think pretty much they're satisfied as long as what their position has been taken into consideration. And as a judge, I used to write lengthy opinions. Lengthy, not according to one I remember that was 900 pages in that sex change case. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. I do.
But I would lay out the evidence I heard, what I considered important, before I gave my decision. So the lawyers knew that their argument had been taken into consideration. Their clients knew that their lawyer was respected by the court, and the court had taken their position into consideration, even though the court ended up going another way. I just thought that was important to the system.
Yeah, and I think that you hit on a really key point for me, someone who's younger as a lawyer. Clients notice what the judges say. Clients notice how the judges react to you in the courtroom. Clients notice when a judge maybe says something snarky to one lawyer that might not be prepared or something like that. And I think it's important if you do put in the opinion that, you know, you understood, you considered what the lawyer argued, you considered their points of view, even if you didn't come out on that side, at least you, the client knows they did their job. When it comes to being a judge, I think a lot of people think it's easy. You just sit up there, all the lawyers do all the hard work, and the judge just sits there and makes a decision off the top of their head. But talk about some of the, you know, laborious tasks you had to do, reading all the motions, reading the case law from both sides, where the lawyer's only maybe reading one side if they haven't seen the motion from the other side. And what do judges actually do in the background when they're not sitting in the courtroom listening to argument, things like that?
They're doing exactly what you said. They're reviewing the briefs, they're reviewing the case law, and they're reviewing their notes. I made a mistake early in my judicial career. I took a case under an advisement and did not rule for about 4 months. And I knew what I wanted to do when I took it under advisement. I just wasn't sure I was going to get there. But before the ink dried on the judgment, I said, this will never happen again. It's not fair to the lawyers. It's not fair to me. It's not fair to the litigants. So every time I took a case under advisement, I would announce when I will have it done by. And I'd put a post-it top of the file. And I think maybe two occasions did I ever have to ask my JA to call the lawyers and tell them I'm going to need another couple days. Other than that, I did it. And I tell the litigants at the time, I say, I do this for two reasons. One is to keep me on track. The other is to keep you from bugging your lawyers. Because trust me, if I do this before this date, they'll call you. So don't bug them. And I just felt that was very important. And I don't think I ever kept more than 2 weeks after I started doing it.
Did you find that, and again, you're off the bench, you can ask this, that there are lawyers that you knew were better prepared than others, or whose research you could rely on in others, and that you didn't always have to go behind their research to check it to make sure it's right?
Short answer is yes.
Okay. So, I guess you don't want to elaborate on that.
Well, what about just like dealing with lawyers in your courtroom? How did you deal with either unethical lawyers or lawyers that would blow up or like to scream and put on a show for no reason? How do you deal with that as a judge?
Well, I found that lawyers really don't want to upset the only person in the room with a vote.
Right.
So you let them know up front how we're going to do it. And I really didn't have them blowing up. Didn't ranting and raving. I had them, as your dad says, a lot much better prepared. There's a very good lawyer in St. Pete who will go absolutely unnamed. Very good. And I used to kid him. I says, you're being disingenuous with the court. And he got all flustered. First I said, what do you mean? What do you say? Well, you say, Judge, I'll be brief. And we both know that's not going to happen. You have researched every single case on the planet, and you want me to know about what each case says. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm okay with that.
And I think maybe your career before becoming a judge, and this is important for people listening too, when you're voting for judges, your career as someone who was making decisions, casting votes thousands and thousands of times, versus someone that maybe does not have a lot of experience making those decisions or just comes from one side of one particular area of law, I think it's a lot harder for them to get control of the courtroom or to understand how important the one vote is and what they have. So I think that's probably a big difference in your courtroom versus some others.
Peter, I think you're right, because a lot of people don't really know that county commissioners are really judges.
Right.
And they have to evaluate testimony, evaluate evidence, and make decisions, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you had all that experience before you even took the bench.
Well, I think another thing is, I think it's very important for judges to have been in private practice, because there's two things that, if you've never been in private practice, two things you've never experienced.
Having a client.
Having a client.
Paying bills.
Attorney-client relationship is very important. And
right.
You mentioned that earlier about judges being snarky to a lawyer. That can destroy an attorney-client relationship.
Right.
And the other, as your dad pointed out, is they've never written a check for overhead. So it's very easy sitting in Clearwater to tell a lawyer from Sarasota, you'd be here for a five-minute case management conference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's bull.
Well, I mean, yeah, or just delaying a case for 6 months for no reason, or allowing continuances on end, you know, for stupid things that should not have happened from one side or the other. Yeah, they just, it seems like some don't see that, but I guess you, I mean, I get it that they have to weigh, you know, fairness and on both sides and how it's going to prejudice the other side. What, since you had such experience as, you know, making judgment calls, making votes prior to being a judge, what was the biggest surprise or something that you weren't necessarily ready for when you became a judge?
Getting paid the last day of the month. You can relate to that. You're an assistant state attorney for a number of years. The state pays you the last working day of the month. So before that, I had my county commission salary, which wasn't great, and I had my private practice. So money could come. I got paid twice a month, or every 2 weeks, I guess, as a commissioner, and then I had private practice. So, you know, I had money coming through. But, you know, when you're a judge, of course, when you're running for judge, you have to pretty much shut down your practice, because you can't have somebody come in 3 months before you're going to take the bench.
Take their case.
Take a big case. And then work it up and then hand it off to another lawyer who has to go back to square one and charge the client again. So I just didn't do much the last 90, 120 days.
You know, now that you've experienced being a judge and you're retired and you're out, what do you think about appointed versus elected judges? Because there's an argument, you know, about whether we should still elect our circuit or trial court judges or whether they should all be appointed. Like our appellate judges are all appointed.
George, it's just a smaller elective base that you're running to get. When you're actually running for election, you got in circuit judge in Sixth Circuit, you got two counties of people registered to vote. When you're applying to be appointed, you have a very small group of politically powerful people calling the shots. So it's still an elective process of sorts. So I actually voted against the, there was a constitutional amendment to, and I don't remember if it was appointed circuit and county or just meritly retained circuit and county, but I voted against that because when you're merit retained, you're running against a mythically perfect judge. So I didn't know what that meant. If I had to run against a person, I knew what that meant. So I voted against it. It actually failed.
I think it was merit retention. Okay. I remember that.
Yeah.
So now you do mediations. We've done a podcast on what a mediation is, what kind of goes into it. But from a judge's perspective, because a lot of judges become mediators after they retire from the bench, what are some of the big differences? Do you like it? I mean, I assume you don't like it as much because it's not quite as much power or fun as being a judge just sitting in the mediator's chair. I wouldn't think. I don't know. I've never been either, but... how do you compare the two? Which did you like better? What's different?
Well, as I say, I think being a judge is the zenith of being a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And so I clearly like that better. Mediating is more lucrative. You don't make decisions. So there's nothing to overturn. You try and talk people into coming closer to the middle and resolving their case. I mean, that's what a mediator is hired to do, and that's what they're supposed to do. And frankly, I don't think I've done my job if we impasse.
How do you feel like being a judge helps you as a mediator?
I think it makes what you say a little more powerful because you've been there. And many times I'd be asked, you know, did you ever serve with this judge? What do you think this judge will do? And I'll say, in one case I remember, I said, well, no, I never served with this judge, but I did preside over her divorce. and they'll ask me, how's a judge going to rule on this? And I invariably I say, I'm not going to answer that for two reasons. One, I'm not supposed to. And two, I have no idea what this judge is going to have in front of him or her when it's decision time.
Or even less a jury.
Yeah.
Right?
So the rap on retired judges is they're either still wearing the robe, they have robitis, and they'll tell you what to do, or they just carry offers back and forth. And I try to be a bit more involved than that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, a client hearing what a judge thinks about a case makes a big difference, especially, a lot of mediators, a lot of really good mediators, practice primarily on one side or the other, depending on what kind of case it is. But a judge gets to, you know, really be impartial, especially when it's when you were a judge for almost 20 years. You probably relate more to being a judge than on either side of any case, unlike some mediators that can't help it. I mean, the same thing as if I was to become a mediator, I couldn't help but see only one side of a personal injury case.
It might be closer to 20 years than you might think. I was city judge of Oldsmar.
Oh, yeah?
For about a year and a half.
Okay.
Back in the early 70s.
About that. Well, that was a biggie. I should have remembered.
Some serious cases probably there. So when you get a higher profile case, and we'll kind of transition to talking about one of the cases that, you know, my dad was a little bit involved in as well, the Terry Schiavo case. How do you handle the media and the pressure kind of from outside the courtroom when you're still inside the bubble, just like any other case, it's important to you, you want to make the right decision. How does the high-profile nature of certain cases affect the judge?
And I think you talk about also your ethical obligations that the Supreme Court puts on you in those kind of cases.
Well, you handle the case itself the same way. The thing that separated the Terry Schiavo case was everything going on around it, outside of the courtroom. Although I did have some contentious lawyering inside the courtroom. But what you're talking about, George, is the receiving ex parte information.
Well, not just that, but the fact that you couldn't comment to the press or you couldn't defend your decisions to the press. Nope. Ethically.
You cannot comment on a pending or impending case. Pending, clearly it's there. Impending is it's likely to be there. And in that case, didn't go away until she passed.
I remember one time, you know, I don't remember this or not, but I saw you in Publix. And so our listeners will know, I disagreed with your opinion in that case. I thought you were wrong, that you'd made a mistake.
It's probably the first time any lawyers ever thought you were wrong.
And that's not the first time George Tragos has thought I did something wrong.
I did. I was just adamantly against your opinion. I thought you were totally off base. But I remember we saw each other in Publix. You may not remember this. And I said, you know, this case is going to stay with you a long time. And you said to me, you really think so? Because I don't think you recognized when you first had that case that it would turn into what it did turn into.
It got legs when the duty judge, and I've never called the duty judge by name, you know, mm-hmm. who that right. judge was in St. Pete, put the feeding tube back in the first time. That's when it got legs.
So that's when it really...
Up till then, it was just a tragic case. And it had gone up on appeal, been affirmed, and it just looked like it was over.
How did you get that case in the first place?
No good deed goes unpunished. In 89. In January, I wake up, I'm going to a new assignment in the criminal division, going to send bad people to state prison, which is a good thing to do. I'm secretary treasurer of the circuit judges convention, conference of circuit judges, the 700 or so circuit judges in Florida. And about midway through that half year, the fella in front of me in the chairs, the incoming chair, gets into an ethical problem. And to make his mea culpa meaningful to the JQC, Judicial Qualifications Commission, he resigned his post as chair-elect. So I went in early. I went in end of June of 1989 as chairman of the Circuit Judges Conference instead of end of June 1990. And I was in crime, and when you're chairman of a conference, you got a lot of administrative stuff to do. The Chief Justice is calling meetings of the conference chairs. And so I couldn't really stay in the criminal division. George, you know that very well. It's a very busy division.
And structured.
Yes.
You have to be there at 8:30, and you're there all day.
Because a state attorney loads a train, and if you're not there to help unload it, it just gets jammed up.
Right.
So I went back to probate. July 1st of 1989. And guess what was there? And I
was
tried.
It already there? Was it already there?
It'd been filed. It'd been going around for a couple of years. They'd appointed a guardian ad litem. Judge Boyer had it, and Richard Pierce did a report, and then was discharged. And then I got it, and I remember the first hearing. I said, "Where's the guardian ad litem?" And they told me he'd been discharged. I said, "Okay." And we tried that in January of 2000. If the fellow in front of me in the rotation hadn't done that, Judge Bruce Boyer would have been the happy recipient of that case. We would have kept it.
In that case, and I haven't had the opportunity before to ask you these things, but so many things were going on. You had her husband was having a relationship with another woman. They had kids. You have her parents who wanted to take control of her situation. Did you see it as simpler than all that, or did you look at all those things and see how complicated what you were doing really was?
No, because the only issue was what would she want to do. The fact that he was having a relationship. Testimony basically was in the first trial that until the money came from the lawsuit, mm-hmm. they were on the same page. Parents encouraged him to date. They were living together to preserve expenses. But when the money came, that's when they had their problem and never spoke after that. They almost came to blows in their hospital room over the money. The parents said that he had promised them.
How do you find out about that?
It was in the testimony.
Okay.
All this is in the public record. Parents' position was he'd promised them half of his award, which was loss of consortium. And then they wanted him to give them an additional kicker so they could pay the taxes, so they wouldn't have to pay taxes out of their half. His position was there never was a discussion like that. And they almost came to blows over that. And they just parted company. So the relationship he had, I didn't think was meaningful. I mean, it had nothing to do with her decision, what she would have decided had she been able to tell us. I just had to go to other evidence of what she would have wanted to do given those circumstances.
Isn't it, I mean, logical, or doesn't it seem logical that you side on the side of life as opposed to on the side of death in a situation like that? And why wouldn't you do that?
George, it wasn't my decision. It's a substituted judgment test, although the statute actually allowed me to go to best interest, which I thought was a truly slippery slope. So it's substituted judgment. So it wasn't my call.
But you had to make a decision. You had to make it. You had to evaluate what you had, and you had to go one way or the other.
Yes.
And you chose to go the way that would eventually end in her dying.
I found from the evidence that the greater weight, whatever test you want to apply, that there was no evidence, really, that she would want to continue that way. And if you'll remember, she got in that condition because she wanted to look good. She was very heavy as a teenager. She became bulimic, became a very beautiful woman. And here she was, being all over the media. But that wasn't part of the consideration. That's just an afterthought. She made several statements that she didn't want to live like that after seeing somebody in that condition. The only evidence contrary to that was a friend who 2 weeks before in a depot could barely remember her name, but now in testimony was saying they were watching a rerun of I think the Karen Quinlan movie.
Right, yes.
And Terry had made some comments to some extent that won't they just leave her alone? I have no idea what that meant, but I did not find that witness terribly credible. So I just treated it like any other case. I mean, it was obviously serious. All cases are serious. Most of them just deal with money.
And one of the things you're talking about is you weren't deciding what you would do. You were trying to decide what she would have done.
That's the test. It's a substituted judgment test.
and judges are asked to make those kinds of decisions. I guess somebody has to.
Right. So when you deal with a case like that, when people are so passionate on both sides, and again, you know, I'm sure there are people that felt like you were making a decision, like my dad just said, you were making a decision whether to choose life or choose death, right? And in your position, you're making the decision as to what you think the right answer is to that, to the actual question, which is, what would she have chosen?
Well, when you say it's my decision, it was in fact my decision.
Right.
I prepared the judgment, I signed my name to it, and I owned it. But what I considered was what she would want. If she could wake up for 30 seconds and tell me, given all these facts, what would she want to do, that's what she would do.
So how do you deal with the aftermath of it? You know, how do you deal with, or did you feel like people disagreed with your decision or people treated you differently because of that case or any other case that you had? How do you deal with that as a judge when a case like that, you know, lasting, what'd you say, it lasted more than 10 years?
Well, she went into cardiac arrest in January or February of 1990,
okay,
before I was on the bench. And she passed on March 31st of 2005.
Okay.
So I had the case for a little over 5 years. People come up to you all the time. I shouldn't say all the time, but a lot. And they'll say, you presided over my divorce. And you can't remember who they are. So my comment to that is, how'd I do? Because you don't know. And you don't know who's watching. I mean, we had pretty significant law enforcement around the clock for a fair number of months.
I was going to ask you about that. You had protection, right?
Oh, yeah. I had a bulletproof vest. When I wasn't in my condo or in my courtroom, I was wearing a bulletproof vest for about 5 or 6 months.
And what is that the only time that's ever happened?
The only time that's ever happened to me.
Okay, what made it get to that level?
The threats.
So people were making threats from you, making it seem like they were making threats based on which side you came down on, or was it both sides, or how did that work?
No, I wasn't being threatened by the people in whose favor I'd ruled.
Oh, you're saying after okay. The ruling. So you're saying after the ruling.
Well, yeah. The original ruling was, I think, February.
And then it kept going on, yeah.
Of 2000. But they set up one of these scanners from the post office in the basement of the courthouse, and they ran all my mail through it, my mail. They intercepted all of my voicemail.
It wasn't embarrassing, was it?
I hope not. They held my mail at the Clearwater Beach post office, and they went through it about twice a week, and they would bring it to me. And the only thing that really upset me about that was when they opened up a bill, they should have gone ahead and paid it. And then we had, for 4, 5, 6 months, we had 3 shifts a day of 2 plainclothes sheriff's deputies. And they took us wherever we went. When my wife went to get her hair done, they'd take her. When I go get a haircut, believe it or not, George, I still get haircuts.
Well, so do I.
Yeah. And he charges full price. But we were in high school together, so I can't turn him in. But they took us everywhere. I mean, in that amount of time, we went out to eat twice. Because it was just such an effort. And they flew us out of town twice because the sheriff felt he couldn't protect us. And the first time we went to the St. Pete, Florida airport, it was like a total of 8 cars. And then bringing us back, we're wondering how we're going to turn down Cleveland. That's before the Hi-Fex Bridge, to get over the bridge. And one of the guys comes wheeling around this pack and pulled, kind of blocked off, southbound on North Fort Harrison at Cleveland. And we just...
Jeez, that sounds miserable.
It was confining.
Yeah.
It really was. First time, I'm talking to one of the plainclothes deputies. And I said, I'm going to go to Publix in a little bit. He said, okay. So I come down. I got my list and stuff, and I look around. I don't see them. Well, they're undercover. Okay. So I walked to Publix. Well, I found out later, he called upstairs, says, isn't the judge going to Publix? And I said, oh, he's been gone probably 20 minutes. And I'm pushing the cart. And all of a sudden, I see one of them whizzing down the back lane, looking down each aisle. And then he stops and he comes back. And I could understand what they were saying on the way to Publix. God, he can't get killed on my watch.
Yeah, he felt real safe. Yeah.
So, and there was some humorous things like that, but it was not a humorous case. I mean, it's life or death.
So, do you think that affected your work on that case at all? Did you put a keener eye to it, knowing that everybody was watching, everybody was reading everything that you did, or did you just handle it kind of business as usual?
I tried to handle it business as usual. Mm-hmm. I just think it's kind of like, as a lawyer, I never took work home. I'd always come back to the office. As a judge, I never took work home. Although I did have one hearing toward the end, sheriff gave me a cell phone, I guess a burner phone, so they wouldn't have my number. And on a Sunday morning, I had a hearing. I'm standing in my kitchen. And the attorney for the parents said, Judge, before we get started, there's something we got to consider. And I said, you mean the motion to disqualify me that you faxed to my office at 12:15 this morning? He said, yes. I said, well, there's an order been prepared and signed denying that motion. You will receive your copy in due course. So let's move on. So with that case, I had to be very sensitive to the fax machine. Today, you'd have to be very sensitive to the internet.
That's right.
Because whenever a motion to disqualify is filed, it takes precedence over everything.
Right.
So you got to consider it and dispose of it.
Everything gets stayed until you're done with that.
I'm glad every judge in the circuit was happy that you didn't disqualify yourself. Because I don't think that anyone would have relished taking that case.
Well, I made the comment, and you may have heard me say it, George, that I made 7 bad rulings in that case. I denied 7 motions to disqualify me. First 4 were actually taken up and were affirmed, my denial.
So when you say taken up, you mean appealed?
Appealed to the second district.
Yeah. Right. So when you're dealing with cases that are long-lasting like that, how do you think it affects when you start to get in a case and you're making a bunch of rulings throughout a case, and some cases can last years, not just this case, do you think that it has an effect on the long-term and the outcome of the case? When they're so long and you continue to have to make rulings, do you find yourself more for the same side, or does it, you know, jump back and forth depending on what the motion is, or how do you deal with some of these cases that last forever?
Well, if you're doing your job correctly, you're taking each motion on its merits. So the fact that I may have denied the last 2 motions you filed doesn't mean that your third motion comes in with a presumption that it's bad.
Right.
If I'm doing my job right, that's the mindset I need to have.
I think you also had the mindset, at least in the Shavo case, that you ruled once and that's the end of it. And that kept your consistency, at least, even though I disagree with the consistency. You kept that consistency, and that you didn't reconsider, you didn't reopen the testimony. You pretty much stuck to your ruling and just enforced it, or tried to enforce it.
Well, you know, there were motions to reconsider, motions for a hearing, and I considered those. After the first trial, the big part was that there was no guardian ad litem. And that was the basis for the first appeal to the Second District Court of Appeal. And they came out with a very novel conclusion, which was new, that in those kind of cases, the court serves as the guardian ad litem. And so they denied the appeal. They affirmed my ruling and made that. When the judge in St. Pete put the feeding tube back in the first time, they reversed that, but ordered a second trial on whether or not there was anything new, that new medical procedures that she would elect to take as opposed to having life support withdrawn. So we had a second trial, 7-day trial on that. And I ruled early on in that one, George, that, and I'm not sure if you were aware of that, it was kind of a minor point, but I ruled that the phrase new medical treatment meant anything she had not had. I said, we're not going to get involved in a discussion. This was out 2 years ago. It's not new. And one of the things that one of the parents' doctors suggested was hyperbaric, and that goes back into the 1800s, I believe. So we had a second trial on that point.
Did you end up, what all divisions did you end up in? Did you end up rotating into all the different ones, criminal, civil,
I was
family?
Never actually assigned to civil, but okay. I did a lot of coverage there, and I tried a bunch of cases in the civil division. Started in juvie, went to probate guardianship, went to family, went back to probate, went to crime, back to probate, finished up in family.
Did you have any control over where you were rotated? Would they ask you, do you get to put in?
Pretty
like,
much.
I'd like to go here.
The more seniority you got, the more you got. The better your relationship with the chief judge, mm-hmm. the better chance you have of going where you want to go.
And I'm sure they take into consideration, because one of the big things with judges, I guess I don't know if this is true in every docket, but I assume is how they move the cases and making sure they're keeping everything moving, stuff's not sitting around getting jammed up.
I just found out that there is a new committee appointed by the Supreme Court. Judge Robert Morris is chairman of it, to kind of figure out how to move cases in civil.
They need that.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it takes forever to get a hearing.
4 months. You can file a motion to compel discovery, and you know you won't get that hearing prior to a 3-month extension on doing your discovery. And then they, as long as they file it before the court orders a motion to compel that discovery, they haven't violated a court order, so you don't really have any attorney's fees and costs provision or anything with teeth to force them to do it any faster. I mean, that's just one example of a million things, but I think that's a good idea.
One of the things that used to get me was there's an administrative order that says before you can go for temporary relief in a divorce case, you have to go to mediation. So that's like a 2-month process to get mediation, and then mm-hmm. another 3 months to get a hearing.
But then you're a mediator, so...
Well, but what I did as a judge, George, if you came to me or you called my office and said, we got to do mediation, but my client really needs some help, we're mediating on August 16th, I'd give you a hearing August 17th in the morning. Just so you don't have that delay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if you're...
Those are used as leverage, really. Delay is used by one side always.
One side favors delay in every case.
Yeah, and that's what I don't understand is some of this stuff that, you know, I think is easily avoidable, but, you know, the system and the court system just doesn't let us avoid certain delays, and then it plays into the hands of one side. You know, I think that logic in setting some of this stuff and being available, especially some of this stuff, some judges that don't let you appear by phone for a 5-minute, you know, discovery dispute.
There's a very good insurance defense lawyer in St. Pete that I know. And we're on the phone one morning, and he's got an associate.
I'm sure I've never met him.
Going to Naples. His first name starts with a J. That help?
Well, I was kidding because you said a very good insurance defense lawyer, but the last one I had a trial against was started with a J.
Last name start with a G?
No.
Okay. Anyway, got an associate going to Naples for a 10-minute case management. And they tried the day before, and the J said, no, the judge wants the attorney here.
Oh, yeah. That happens all the time.
That's
it makes
wrong.
No sense. I know.
That's wrong. Now, maybe the judge is trying to feed local lawyers who will get hired to make the appearance, file a notice of appearance, but it's just wrong. If I had lawyers on stuff like that in the legal arts building, which is catty corner from the courthouse, appear by phone. I didn't care. If you want to appear by phone, I know what you look like.
We appear by phone right here in Clearwater all the time,
There are still judges with all the new rules about telephones. There are still judges that require appearance.
And especially if it's the 17th hearing in a case 2 years into it, and I've already appeared 10 times in court. You know, some of the stuff is just
it's evidentiary, I wanted you there.
Sure, sure.
If you're just arguing, you know, case law, or you're arguing a legal point, that's okay. I don't need you there.
Most of the 5-minute hearings, we resolve with the lawyers before we walk into the courtroom anyway. It's just getting that date, forcing them to show up in court where they know now a judge is going to make a decision on a motion that's obviously going to go one way, but they'll take all 3 months if we have to wait 3 months for the hearing. It's just nice for judges have, you know, some control over the process and can speed it up. But
one way they could do it is schedule at 4:30 on Friday afternoon motions to compel.
Yeah, I agree. I'm down with that.
It would get resolved.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, Judge, thank you so much for coming on. It was a lot of fun. We'll post this up on iTunes and SoundCloud everywhere. We'll let you know where it is, but it was a good conversation. Got anything else, Dad?
No. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Travis.
I still like you.
You're still a friend of mine. You're not as nice as your father was.
You're right.
Yeah, definitely.
He knew Papa.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew your mom.
Yeah. All right. That's a wrap with Judge Greer. A lot of blasts from the past there, old time Clearwater here. So that was a good podcast. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it, and we'll be back with you next time.
You've been listening to Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Trakos. The experienced lawyers at Trakos, Sartes & Trakos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field. Find out more at TrakosLaw.com.